I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Pondway Gibson. Pondway is making going green cool, practical, and profitable. After founding a network of schools, Pondway dove into the business world, where she started, led, and scaled three successful companies. Through EcoTech Visions Incubator, she is guiding entrepreneurs towards hatching green manufacturing in Miami. Pondway has a Bachelor of Arts from Scripps College, a Master's of Arts in Teaching and Learning from Claremont Graduate University, a Master's in Leadership from Harvard Graduate School, and a PhD from Claremont Graduate University. Pondway has lived, studied, taught, and worked internationally at notable universities such as the University of Legon in Ghana, Sorbonne University in France, and Oxford University in England. Pondway, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have a really interesting background where you've done lots of different things in what seems like a relatively short time. I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit and tell us a little bit about your story.
Well, I'm originally from Chicago and New Orleans. My parents are from those two places, so I sort of moved between those two growing up. I had an amazing opportunity to go out and study in California. Coming from an inner city, low income environment, the first route that you typically take is the military, especially in the Midwest. So I was initially graduating high school, choosing between the branches of the military. Did I want to be a Marine, or did I want to be in the Army, or did I want to be in the Navy? Ultimately, I chose the Marines. I was really excited. I wanted to be a leapfrog, which are the people who jump out of the planes. And I took the test. I was going to enter as an officer. It was really exciting because I had applied to university, which tends to be the track that you think you're supposed to go to, but it was exorbitantly expensive. I applied to Big Ten schools, and I just, the cost was just not even possible. So I started a leadership group that I was a part of with another group of students, and we were going on a college tour to California. We were going to visit one of the schools that I applied to, actually two of them, UCLA and USC. I gotten into both of them, but the tuitions were staggering. And I took a chance and went out there on the college tour with the group of children. At the time, it was my senior year of high school. So, and the other students, some of the other students on the trip, it was their junior year of high school. So they were going to check out schools. One of the schools we went to check out was the Claremont Colleges. Now, I was overwhelmed by UCLA's campus. It's beautiful, but it was huge. It was like its own city. And one of the mentors on the college tour graduated from the Claremont Colleges. And I had never heard of these schools before. Absolutely never heard of them before. So I wanted to stay in the city and go to the Getty Museum and tour around LA. And she said, no, come to Claremont, check it out. It's a really interesting school. None of us on the tour had ever heard of it. It was students from Chicago, Boston, and New Orleans on this college tour. And I said, okay, I knew I was going to the Marines afterwards, but why not? Let me go look at this school. We went to the campus. Absolutely stunning. If you've never been to Claremont, California and seen the five colleges, seven colleges, I mean, Scripps College is one of the most beautiful campuses in the nation. They get voted in Better Homes and Garden. They have rose gardens and orange groves and an olive grove. And I mean, just absolutely stunning. And so while we're on the tour, I'm falling in love with this environment. I mean, coming from Chicago and New Orleans, I had never seen a place like that.
Yeah, it's very different.
Yes. So when we got out there, I'm like, okay, I like this place. And we sat and got to talk to the teachers. We got to sit in the class. The classes had four students, a college course. I'm like, how is this possible versus the classes I sat in at UCLA where there were 400 students in one class? I just thought it was an amazing environment. Then we sat in a financial aid talk where they told us the school cost $45,000 a year. And I was like, oh, okay, never mind. And my mentor, the woman on the trip who had gone to the school, she said, you know what? If you want to go here, you should try. So I thought about it. We left. I called the financial aid office and the admissions office of all the schools. And I actually got to talk to the director of admissions for Scripps College. So when I called, which is unusual, right?
Yeah.
Oh, so when I called, I said, hey, you know, I was on the college tour with one of your former students. She goes, oh, yes, because we were the only Black kids for miles, right? Because it is definitely a monolithic environment as it relates to race and class. And she was like, oh, okay, I remember you guys. I remember you. And I said, hey, I really need to go to this school. And she said, okay, you know, the application process is next fall, you can apply. Applications are due in December. I said, no. I need to go to this school now. I need to go here in September. So she got silent. She was like, you know, the other students who were here had already been accepted. You've well missed the application process. I said, listen, I'm supposed to go to the Marines in a couple weeks. I need to go to this school. This is where I'm supposed to be, and I know it. And she said, she paused for a minute, and she said, do you have access to a fax machine? And I said, yes. She faxed me the application. I faxed it back to her the same day. So I'd already had all my essays together and my letters of recommendation because I'd been applying to colleges. Faxed me back to her the same day. Within 2 weeks, I had been accepted to Scripps College. Within another couple months, I remember being in the back of a taxi in Chicago, and the director of financial aid called me and gave me my financial aid package. It had everything but $2,000 covered. And that's how I ended up at Claremont. And that really was the gateway that opened my eyes to the opportunities that if people from the city were exposed to them, they could excel. And obviously I excelled after that. So I took advantage of absolutely every opportunity I could from that point forward. I worked full time through college because, of course, even though they paid the tuition, they didn't cover, you know, living expenses and other things like that. I had a full time job in LA, which was an amazing opportunity doing community organizing for me to see the difference between those stark environments. And I took advantage of opportunities to travel abroad, which everybody did at the school. And I went abroad 3 different times, undergrad, and then several times in grad school, and got an opportunity to study at partner universities through that process. And it's just since then, my mission and my work has been about how do you create opportunities for economic development in low-income communities, because that is the vehicle to having a happy, healthy, fulfilled life. And that's how I got here.
Wow. And Pondway, how critical do you think it is to have someone open your eyes to a possibility like the mentor you mentioned who was on that trip?
I mean, it is absolutely imperative. So the mentor on that trip was Itoy Reginald. She's actually a major, she runs a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., huge community advocate as it relates to education, students' rights, et cetera, and obviously modeled that in her relationship with me. And I would say along my way, I've had a tremendous resource of mentors, both women and men, but mostly really amazing women who have helped pave the way for me. Right now, one of my mentors is Patty Sulfur, really, really awesome woman, author, educator, and a developer of marketing and branding, and just an amazing eye who's helped with the framework that I have for Ecotech now. So, I mean, I've always had mentors sort of pave the way for me in different ways, and Itoy and Patty would be great examples of that.
You know, Patty is a great example. So talk to me a little bit about some of the kinds of projects that you have been able to launch once you finished with your formal education.
Immediately, I guess in the throes of my PhD, I was living my life in California and Hurricane Katrina happened. And when Hurricane Katrina happened, I knew I had to get home. I was considering dropping out of school. My mother emphatically said no. And I knew I wanted to make a difference in my home area. So I decided to complete my studies. And because most of my degrees were in California, I knew I had to add some diversity to that background and a little more status to be able to make some real difference when I go back. Like, I didn't want to go back as a teacher because I knew I'd get swallowed up because there was so much work to do. So I applied to Harvard, got into Harvard, and went through a leadership program that was very much about designing frameworks and organizational frameworks to actually grow and scale organizations, particularly looking at educational practices, but organizations in general. So I used that to write a charter, and that charter became the first CMO, charter management organization, in the South to open multiple schools per year. So we opened 6 schools the first year, 11 the second, and 16 the third year. The organization is called Renew. And we were the first to sort of take on how do you reform an educational system that was already defunct before this disaster and scale it at capacity. Because if you remember, schools post Katrina, everything turned charter, but they were opening one school at a time. And for the volume of children who needed support, that was not effective. Not to mention, they were choosing whole sections of students to excess because of behavior, because of grades, because of lots of different issues. And we took on taking all of those children that nobody wanted to deal with. We had major success. Our schools end up ranking in city and state. We took over schools that were physically condemned and turned them around to be beautiful examples of what you could do if you thought more structurally as it relates to resource distribution. And so we did a couple of things that were nuanced. Like we accessed all of the custodians and all of the security staff over 6 different schools. We had 1 custodian and 1 security worker because, you know, especially in my case, I actually went on to be the founding principals of one of the schools, and it was a middle school. So having studied abroad, having studied in Asia, studied in these other countries, and realized they don't have custodians in their school at all. At all. They don't have security in their school at all. And so thinking about the model and the things that we think are necessary and taking those things away, we freed up $500,000 of funding, and we took that funding and transitioned that over to direct services, teachers, right? Put the money to education, and guess what happens? Kids learn. I was recruited to DC and Philadelphia to grow schools in those 2 areas. But something significant happened to me in that process. I realized a couple things. One, your reward in social services is often that you're moved in order to show that you're successful. And that kind of didn't work for me. Like, I build up this amazing system and then I'm recruited away, as opposed to given an opportunity to grow it further in the environment that I was already seeding it. And then 2, about 4 months into my time in DC, one of my students was killed. And, you know, when you're a principal, you report the grades, you report all the great strides you made academically. I had a 100-piece band march in Mardi Gras, which with kids who had never played instruments before, like all these amazing successes. You never think to say, oh, and by the way, I never lost a child, until it happens, right?
Right.
And it was just a really difficult moment for me to think that. It really made me rethink the institution itself and the way we were going about it, and whether the way we were going about it was the most sustainable way. And it obviously wasn't. And the thing that I realized is that you cannot help children if you do not create economic opportunities for the parents and the community. And so really my work shifted to the work that I do now in education, because people always say, well, you left schooling, you were so good at it. I left schooling, but I'm very much still in education, but education around economic development. So my work now is about creating opportunities to grow middle America, because that's when we were the strongest nation. That's when we were the most educated nation. That's when we were able to produce and create opportunities for our children, was when parents were thriving, when families were thriving. And that happened through the Industrial Revolution, through our ability to create products, to develop those products out, and to do it effectively. So what I do now is a lot of R&D, a lot of organizational scaling, but specifically looking at businesses that are manufacturing based and product based. So I grow entrepreneurs and I grow the workforce for those entrepreneurs so that we can create opportunities to grow the middle class.
Where do you see the biggest opportunities given the state of the economy and this and the current state of education in this country?
So I am extremely hopeful about this, and that's the work that I'm doing right now. I think the greatest opportunities are in tech and the spectrum of tech. So from mid to low tech to high tech, and utensil-based technology, meaning product-based development that has a technological element to it, there are tremendous opportunities for America to continue its role as the leading nation. And so I'll give you some concrete examples. In our makerspace, in our incubator, we have 18 companies right now. Those companies range from an electric motorcycle company called Alias. They develop fleet-based models and one-off designs of electric motorcycles, and they're tremendous and spectacular. And I'll give you some concrete examples from that company. So Alias started with an engineer and an architect. They came, they have this brilliant idea. They want to develop out a company, right?
Right.
And we have lots of engineers and architects graduating with advanced degrees who don't see career track opportunities for them to innovate. So we create that opportunity for them in our space. But they don't actually do the building. Who does the building is the electrician and the mechanic. We have, as a country, lots of those people with blue collar skills who are displaced, out of work, and disproportionately not being recognized as the growing class in our society. That's that middle group that we could transition their skill set, but aren't really doing the training to do. So we do it at Ecotech. At Ecotech, we actually provide the training. We provide solar panel training. We also provide transitional opportunities for them. So we pair the electrician and the mechanic with the architect and the engineer. And here we now have a group that can create a prototype and bring a prototype to market a lot quicker than it's happened in the past, right? So the four of them have a prototype now, but what they don't have is any background in PR or finance or HR management, which is not a problem if you have a group of people who can fill that gap in terms of workforce. And guess what? Our universities are full of students graduating with degrees in things like HR management, who we hear consistently can't find jobs, end up working at Walmart or the Gap because they can't find jobs in their career track. And what we do at Ecotech is we actually offer them paid internships into the company structure. And now you have a company that can thrive. So I think that the largest opportunity is that pairing, is looking at the different groups in our community that are under-resourced and using what America has always been great at, which is innovation in the product and utensil market, and using technology to sort of bolster and grow that. And then on top of that, we learn from our mistakes in the first Industrial Revolution and the second. So the first Industrial Revolution and the second Industrial Revolution, what had American production decline was there were two reasons. One, because it wasn't cost effective. Well, both because they didn't find it cost effective to do business in America. But one, because of the rise of the EPA, so the need to address environmental regulations. And two, because of the rise of unions and the need to pay workers fair wages. We actually deal with both of those in our model. So all the products that we create are carbon neutral. They all are produced in a way that benefits the environment, hence an electric motorcycle company. We also have a company that creates utensils, forks, spoons, and knives out of potato and corn. The company's called Earthware. It's earthwareinc.com, I believe is their website. We have a company that develops aquaponics systems for restaurants and museums and places like that. It's called Fruit of Life Organics. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of opportunity in our community. And that's the opportunity in America. The opportunity is to give our country back to the innovators because they're here. I mean, that's really who we are. So by nature, the ideas here tend to be environmentally friendly and environmentally thoughtful. And so that's why we're doing the work here, to show that there is a way to do green and to do sustainability in manufacturing and in product-based development and create opportunities for a community.
Pondway, how important do you think it is to have a collaborative and supporting infrastructure to be able to develop the kind of companies that are part of your incubator?
Tremendously important. So, I mean, the example I just gave you about literally there was no infrastructure or ecosystem to support developers is why it doesn't exist. If people are wondering, you know, why are these products not on the market? How come you can't buy them at Target or at these different places? That's the reason, because the infrastructure of support is not there to bring them to that level. In America, I think we've made the mistake of focusing a lot on big business and trying to get big business to make the shift, but that's not historically how innovation has happened. Innovation has happened from a disruptive sort of framework, and we have to make room for new inventors as opposed to just looking at those MVPs from the past to create the future. If you take in a sports analogy, you know, we love Michael Jordan, but we're not looking at Michael Jordan to lead the league right now. We're looking at LeBron. We're looking at that next high school person to come out of the of high school. We look back into our community for the next great thing. And I think as it relates to innovation and as it relates to product development, we need to develop the ecosystem to grow and seed that type of innovation the same way we do in sports. We're always thinking, you know, what's the next best thing for America? It's actually just reviving and tweaking the old thing that we have led and why we're here in the first place, products. America became great because of the light bulb. What made America the first world nation? The light bulb, the hanger, the tire, right? It's like little simple inventions. And now we know we should care about the environment. So why not do them in a way and take time to invent them in a way that actually creates opportunities that balance both our life and the life and value of the planet. It's not complicated. And even if it is, we've got droves of inventors all around us who would love to tackle that problem. We just need to create opportunities for them. And that's what we do. We literally seed ideas, but ideas that will benefit our planet and benefit our community. And we do it from a market-based standpoint because doing it through the market speaks for itself, right? That, I mean, like
yeah, people vote with their feet.
Exactly.
And people are what drives the market.
Exactly.
Pondway, what do you see as some of the critical success factors to be able to grow and scale organizations? Because clearly you've had success doing it.
I think the culture, so putting together effective and productive teams, are important. I also think succession planning is huge. So with our companies, we start in the beginning with they have a five-year goal framework, and they also have a template where they identify their gaps and their limitations. And we literally spend the year filling their gaps, like putting in people or resources to fill the gaps in their own personal leadership structure. And so you have to be willing to be reflective and identify where your shortcomings are as a leader. I mean, we fundamentally spend a lot of time sort of figuring out, okay, you're good at engineering, but you don't know anything about this. Who can we bring onto your team to fill that gap? And how can we make sure you know how to manage them? And I think that would be the number one thing, too. America's really great at small business and developing small businesses, but we're not so great about getting those small business to mid-size or to large. And I would say fundamentally the skill set necessary to do that is management skills and getting people able to know a little bit about the discipline from a managerial side, but be comfortable having people work for you that are a trillion times smarter than you in that area, in their skill set. And that's something we spend a lot of time doing for our small business owners that we're moving to mid-size and then larger than that. I think one of the big misconceptions that you hear a lot of time if you're listening to Wall Street or to Congress right now and their debate on how you move people out of poverty, a lot of times you hear them speaking about, well, this trickle-down effect. And there's never been a trickle-down. It's always been the middle class creating opportunities for the poor and maybe the wealthy creating opportunities for the middle class, but there's never going to be the wealthy creating opportunities for poverty. And vice versa, poverty does not want to be wealthy. The people in poverty want to make it to middle class. They want to sustain. They want to be able to thrive. They want to be able to take care of their children, take them to school, like basic needs. And so we're really creating opportunities for people to fit into the place they actually want to be in. For organizational scaling, you really have to look at the assets of your community and then grow and capitalize on those.
Pondway, what's the single most important thing in business that focusing on that one thing has meant all the difference for you and your success?
Okay, so I would say the most important strategy would be focusing on the assets of your community and of the area that you work. So in business language, they usually say identify your niche or know what the gaps are in the market and exploit them. But I would say look at it from an asset base. So look at who your consumer is and what they need. And then I would say in terms of a business person navigating the market, it's relationships. I mean, it's relationships with everything. It's life is about who you know. And we do a lot of that work with the companies we work with, literally creating opportunities for them to meet and be in the space of the people who can help them advance their business in different ways. So building relationships both for myself and also for the company is tremendous. It's the only way to grow in this world, period.
What roadblocks do you see repeatedly in business?
I think people have, I don't see as much courage as I would like to try new things. And I think in America in general, like across sector, but specifically in business, people like to stick with what works until what works literally dies, as opposed to shifting and trying something new. Especially the notion that I mentioned earlier, that people are always looking to big business to solve the problem. And it's just like that lack of agility and that lack of willingness to really look at and take regular inventory or data for all of your all of the assets you have around them and then focus on the ones that can be the most successful. I think that is fundamentally the roadblocks. We don't see big business move like, for example, the example of Edison and the light bulb. When Edison started the light bulb and took it to GE, GE was on the train of the gas lantern, and they were really focused on bringing the gas lantern to market. But when they realized that the halogen light bulb was better, and they had this better technology, GE, a major company at the time, we're talking in the early 1900s, but a major company at the time, took the chance and switched their entire production line to the light bulb. And here we are today. You don't see major companies taking opportunities to innovate in that way, which is fine because that leaves an opening for small business. And so I would love to see more companies do what Edison did, do what GE did, and make those kinds of shifts. Or I would at least like to see a government that supports and builds innovation from a grassroots standpoint so that that level of disruption can happen again in business the same way we see it in athletics. You don't see people saying, hey, Michael Jordan, you should still be playing. Everybody knows that's not going to happen, you know, but we still expect that from our big businesses now. And I think that's the largest misconception.
Pondway, this is all very exciting. You've clearly accomplished quite a lot in education and business. What do you do for fun?
Oh, I work. Well, I live in Miami, so I did go to the beach on Saturday after I got off work at 5 o'clock and it was still sunny. I got 2 hours of sun. So I would say I'll go to the beach as much as I can. It's a beautiful opportunity to be able to live in such an amazing and beautiful place. And I try to take advantage of it and remind myself as much as possible.
That's great. Pondway, who do you know personally who's doing really remarkable work?
I don't know if I should. I have 18 companies at the incubator, and quite frankly, all of them are doing amazing work. And if your viewers are interested, they can find out more about the companies on our website at ecotechvisions.org. And we'll be doing a major launch on April 30th called Hashtag Local Is. So it's a Twitter-a-thon. It'll be a whole Twitter campaign and social media campaign where we'll be speaking to what's happening and the amazing work that's happening in the community. There's a number of different organizations. Felicia and Derek Hatcher have an organization called Cold Fever. They just put on the first ever international Black Tech Week. You can check that out at blacktechweek.com. They're doing tremendous, tremendous work in terms of bringing diversity conversations into the tech movement. And like I said, the first ever conference, which had international support from the Caribbean, Central, South America, Africa, and Europe, and Canada. So really all continents, with the exception of Australia and Antarctica were involved in this year's Black Tech Week, which was tremendous in Miami. It'll be happening again next year in February 2016. There's so many people doing amazing work. I think social media is a great way to sort of get abreast of what's happening in the world, but I'm impressed every day. I think that engineers are really going to design a better world for us and that we need to create opportunities for them to do that. Of our 18 companies, 14 of them are engineer-led. And think about it. When have we heard about engineers having the opportunity to really to advance their skills in society? And so that's really what I'm focused on, creating the opportunities for them to grow and fix all the problems that we've created for our children and our children's children. The companies I cited, Earthware, Alias, Fruit of Light of Gampus, Sheet. We have a 3D printing company called Sheet. It's SHE3T is their website.com. And they are doing tremendous work in the digital development in terms of helping people do prototypes. So they actually prototype people's products and then they can then produce them at large scale manufacturing and go after funding. I mean, tremendous that they're even fixing the problems of the supply chain in terms of how you get things to market quickly.
Awesome. In addition to your website, are there other places where listeners can learn more about you?
Obviously our social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Ecotech Visions, Ecotech Visions 1, and through the different companies' websites, which you can link through our website.
Terrific. Pondway, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Pondway Gibson, founder and executive director of Ecotech Visions. Thank you again, Pondway, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.